Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, we're facing big changes and very big challenges in our lives today with the pandemic that's sweeping across the world. Today, we're talking about something that might bring those anxiety levels down a little and make life a little less challenging and a little more sunny. My guest wants everyone to make creativity a joyous way of life. And maybe with the time you're spending at home that normally you'd spend sitting in the car commuting to work, her new book could help you unleash the creative within you. Let me tell you a little bit about my guest. She is creative alchemist Diana Rowan. She's the founder of the Brightway Guild, a virtual learning environment dedicated to transforming and inspiring a global community of creatives. She's also a professional musician and composer, performing and teaching in the San Francisco Bay Area and around the world. Her website is dianarowan.com, and her new book is called The Bright Way, Five Steps to Freeing the Creative Within. Here's my guest, Diana Rowan. All right, well, Diana Rowan, I want to welcome you to Conversations Live. Very pleased to have you here, and I enjoyed going through your book, The Bright Way. Five Steps to Freeing the Creative Within is what we're talking about today. So welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
And you say you wrote the book because you believe we're all creative, regardless of age, current beliefs, current situations, and that we must be creative if, in fact, we want to feel fulfilled in life. So let's begin with what you mean by that.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that creativity is only for traditional artists, you know, musicians, painters, and things like that. And I actually don't believe that at all. I think those are great ways to express creativity, but there are so many ways to express creativity. And I define creativity as direct engagement with whatever you're doing. Because when you directly engage with, it could be conversation, like what we're having. I mean, we're being creative right now. When you engage with your cooking, you know, it doesn't become so much of a chore. It's actually a creative act. You could engage in raising your children. You're actively engaged in the thing. You know, it makes you feel that you are empowered and excited rather than worried, am I doing it right? What are the rules, you know?
Right.
So I think creativity is a way for people to reclaim their engagement with life. And I think what I've seen around me is people feeling less engaged with their life, more disconnected. And I wanted to find an answer to that. And I found that, you know, creativity is available to us all right now inside us. And especially at this moment, we're having to call on it.
Right. Right. Well, we were just chatting before the show, we talked here. And, you know, I said to you, I think this is the perfect timing for the launch of your book, really, because so many people are being forced to live differently right now because of the coronavirus. And so many people are working from home. So they've gained all these hours from their daily commute. I don't necessarily think that applies to people with children, but, you know, certainly if they don't have children, they've probably got extra free time on their hand. And so it's a good chance for somebody to really maybe take a look at a project that they've put on the back burner for a long time, or to, you know, if they've always thought they're not creative, to dive into your work and say, hell, yes, I am creative.
Absolutely. And I think it's a way for people to feel empowered. I think this is a situation where many people are feeling disempowered because they don't know what's going to happen. And the thing is, none of us ever know what's going to happen in life at all, to tell you the truth, right? I mean, a lot of life is unknown. We can't necessarily predict it. Now, it's far more unpredictable right now than it has for many of us in our life ever been. But we can answer it again with creativity, with something we already have. We don't need to wait for the next piece of news in order to know what to do. We can actually just engage with our lives right now. And I'm hearing about people, you know, doing that home improvement project. I know that I'm going around and actually looking at my library of books and reading stuff.
Right.
And, you know, there's so much we already have available to us in our houses right now that we can engage with. You know, there has been this big movement for decluttering, right?
Right.
We have so much stuff and that we don't use it. And it's like, well, here's a chance to actually use that stuff that's right here, right now.
Absolutely. And even if we want to clear it so we can get rid of it later too, that's another thing. I actually went through my book room because I had hundreds and hundreds of books in there and I had to let some of them go. I want to share your story with our listeners, because you say that most people are totally unaware of the vast potential they have inside themselves, and that their story is your story. And you had incredible performance anxiety. And ultimately, this has led to the work that you're doing now in the Bright Way. So would you share your story with us and that turning point for you? Because it was quite pivotal.
Yeah, so I started music when I was about 8 years old. And right away, it was clear I would be a professional musician. I loved it so much. And I would practice all the time. And I just loved it. And I was super close to my teacher, who I still know, actually, right now. And as time went on, I began to be more aware of sort of external pressures, external ideas, such as competitions, grading, things like that. And I began to turn my whole frame of reference outside of myself. I began to be really concerned about what other people thought of me, where I ranked, would I be good enough? You know, I completely lost touch with why I was actually making music in the first place, but I did not know that because I was still a kid. All I knew is I felt terrible, and I felt terrified to perform. I became worse and worse. I would run off stage, I would cry, I would throw up, I would do all sorts of things. Eventually, my teacher took me out of competitions because I could not handle it at all. And I was so ashamed of this. I felt like it was a sign that I had no talent after all. And weirdly enough, I persisted. I did keep taking lessons. I did keep taking exams and making progress. But there was also always this thing hanging over my head. I can't actually perform. What am I going to do? You know, and I kept thinking, oh, something magical will happen. It will just click and I won't be afraid anymore. And all that happened was it would just get worse and worse and worse. And eventually I went to college to be a music major, and I just felt like, you know what? I'm going to have a very short life at this point because I am so stressed and terrified on a regular basis, and I just knew I couldn't carry on. So I actually quit music. I absolutely quit it, and I had no backup plan at all. Instead, I just switched majors, and I began working in social welfare situations because I've always been really interested in health and the empowerment of people. And I would work in battered women's shelters, in halfway houses, and free clinics. And in those environments, I saw people who really had hit rock bottom. You know, I thought I'd hit rock bottom because I'd given up my dreams completely.
Yes, yes.
But seeing them, I was like, no, you know, this is rock bottom. I can still do something for them. And I would show them little things on the piano. There would always be some kind of, you know, junky old keyboard around. And when people would, you know, pick out little tunes on the piano, I would see this light in them. And I would see this power, you know, spark back to life within them. And I started to remember just what music meant to me. And how powerful it had been for me to know myself. So I knew that when they were playing, they were coming back to their true selves, their true strength. Everything had been taken from them, absolutely everything. You know, their health, their job, their family, their housing, And still, there was something that remained inside them that they could access through their creativity, through their direct engagement. And so they inspired me to actually start renting a piano just for myself. I was like, nobody will hear me.
Right, no pressure, no pressure.
I'll just, yeah, exactly, no pressure. It was all just for me.
Yeah.
And then my roommates, you know, would hear me playing. And they were like, hey, could you show us stuff? And so I started showing them stuff. And I could see both their empowerment and also them reminding me even more clearly why I make music.
Yes.
I make music, you know, to know my true self.
Yes, you say your fears had totally disconnected you from knowing yourself, and that ultimately, you know, making friends with the darkness within yourself, as you call it, this led to the work that you're doing in the Bright Way. One of the things I want to talk about, because I know many people who struggle with this, Diana, is that they so fiercely self-identify with whatever they're creating that it makes them very, very vulnerable, almost vulnerable to the point where they don't want to do anything creative. And you say in the book, it's important to remember that the products of your creativity reflect only part of you. They're not actually you. So would you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's something many people struggle to overcome.
Yeah, and I definitely identified very much with the products, you know, with the end results in the past. And
yeah, now I've been there too, yeah.
Right. Now I know it's all about the journey. It's all about the process. The products are simply results of your process. When we focus just on the end result, we forget how we got there. And the only way we can actually get there is the journey, is the process, the day-to-day of being creative. So by recommitting to the idea that it's actually every minute that you're being creative, it's every moment that builds up in your creativity that results in these milestones that we call products, you know, they are simply a milestone along that journey. Because as soon as you do reach that milestone, and it's nice to celebrate those are real things, you know, as humans, we want to feel like we're achieving something. We have to realize it's just a milestone. And then we carry on our journey. And as we're walking along and enjoying our journey, we know there's a milestone ahead, but we're not obsessing and just looking at that sign and forgetting everything else that's actually on the ground right now,
right,
getting us there. You know, so I think by identifying more with the process, we're identifying more with the what's the next step? What's the next thing I can do? Rather than, you know, that metaphor of looking to the top of the mountain immediately and saying, that's where I need to be. And then feeling completely overwhelmed. Like, how am I going to get there?
Right.
So, you know, it's just those day-to-day actions that add up to climbing the mountain. You know, putting one step in front of the other and also being creative about that. You
yes.
know, because as you move from step to step, things change. Things change on an hourly basis, especially right now. And we want to be able to respond to that. We want to be flexible. We want to be relevant and respond to it in a way that actually has heart in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel it's very much by focusing on the process that we gain that kind of creative momentum and also inspiration and confidence.
So let's look at that process that you developed on a high level, because you go into great detail about this in the book, but you developed five sequential steps. They're sequential, yet it's a circular process. Each step builds on the previous. And you begin with defining your purpose. And I know, again, this is something many people struggle with. You talk about how you defined yours because you kind of got sidetracked and got back on again. How did you define your purpose ultimately?
You know, it was funny how I came about defining it was, you know, I would have to write these concert programs about myself. And those are basically where you say what you are about. And as I was writing these over and over again, I kept feeling like, you know what? I am seeing a thread here. And as I'm writing about my process with music and who I am as an artist, I'm coming to realize that the whole reason that I make music, that I share music, is it brings me back to my true self. This is a thread that keeps coming through. And in doing so, coming back to my true self, I hope to encourage others to do the same. And I came to realize this was actually my purpose. This was my purpose in making music. When I sit down to practice, my purpose is to come back to my true self and hopefully inspire others to do the same. When I compose, exactly the same purpose. When I teach, same purpose. You know, I try to be my true self with my students so that they can be their true selves. And I thought, well, if I have a purpose, everybody must have one. And so I would ask people, what attracted you to music? What's your reason for making music? And, you know, they would initially say something like, oh, I really like this certain song or certain type of music. I'd say, okay, why? I would keep asking why, you know, and it would go back further and further and deeper and deeper. And eventually something would come out that was always extremely profound. You know, I play music in order to heal myself. My purpose is to find healing and to share it with the world. You know, my purpose is bliss. You know, one of my students, her purpose is bliss, to experience bliss and therefore to spread it in the world. And so I found that when we go back to our real reasons for creating, we find our purpose is there. And one of the easiest ways to do this is to actually go back to your childhood, because I believe actually our purpose is with us as soon as we're born. And that when you remember being a child and being lost in something in a beautiful way, just lost in time and feeling so connected and inspired, when you recall those feelings and write them down and start to pull out the themes of those feelings, your purpose is embedded right there. It's accessible to you immediately.
Yes, yes. Step number two is setting intentions. And I want to talk about how you define the difference between goals and intentions and setting goals that stick.
Yeah, so very much like we were talking about the difference between products and process, for me that's the difference between goals and intentions. When we set a goal, we become very product-oriented and we just are, you know, looking at the top of the mountain and then overwhelmed. When we set an intention for something to happen instead, we are much, much more focused on the day-to-day and what it's going to take step-by-step. And we also stay very open-minded, you know, because it's an intention, not a goal set in stone. When we set an intention, we may have the latitude to change our mind slightly, to morph the thing so that it becomes something else. You know, I've heard about painters who are painting and they find that the painting reveals itself to them. It changes as they're doing the thing. You know, they don't have a set picture in mind, you know, a very ultra-realistic picture that then they have to reproduce. Instead, they're going with the process. I've heard about writers who are saying, well, I write and the character reveals themselves to me. They speak to me. You know, I see people who are raising their children in very creative ways where they're really responding to the child. And, you know, we hear these stories, and I've witnessed them, of parents who perhaps had a child who learns in an unusual manner, and they get all kinds of very, you know, negative diagnoses. So this child is labeled this way and that way. And instead, the parent responds creatively and decides to go with the child and work with them in their own way. And the results can be absolutely astonishing. And I share one of those in the book, actually two stories where both of the children had had very bad learning diagnoses. And one of them is now a PhD and a professor, and the other is a high school teacher. Yeah. So,
great stories. Like, yeah. And so, I'm just going to skip over step three, unless there's something specific you want to say about it. It's practicum plan. In other words, map your dreams. Step four is integration, and I want to talk about fulfillment, which is step five. because you write, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, if you're feeling reluctant to toot your own horn, which many creatives do, let me reassure you that fulfillment has an enormous effect on your creative process. It's also the most overlooked step, and without practicing fulfillment, you can't attain sustainable creativity. So that fulfillment, the end goal there, is really key.
Yes, definitely. So fulfillment is where you sit down and you literally revel in your accomplishments. You own your accomplishments and you feel completely proud of them, like mind, body, soul. You viscerally recall the things that you are proud of doing, and you fill up with that knowing that those are the things that you actually did. And it doesn't matter if someone else might think that thing is totally unremarkable. It is remarkable to you, and that's all that counts. And so you really take that time to detail what it is that you are proud of that you've achieved, and you write it down. And I have never once in hundreds of cases had anybody disappointed at this. I've had people highly resistant and they didn't want to do it, and they felt like, you know, I'm not going to have enough. I always they are surprised that once they start writing those things out, a whole tome of amazing material comes out that they can be proud of. And this is important for two huge reasons. The first is that it fills you up with joy and inspiration. And to me, those give great confidence going forward. When you have, and they also give great momentum. So, you know, motivation is something that we talk about a lot in creativity, having motivation. And it's been interesting, in interviews I've been asked a lot, what do you do with creative block? And I do not get creative block. And that is because I practice fulfillment. You know, I will carry on. When we have this joy, that leads to, as I say, confidence and inspiration. And those are the things that lead to further motivation. Those are the things that are truly sustainable motivation. We can motivate ourselves with things like deadlines and various threats to ourselves, but if we are instead motivated by inspiration, by joy, those are sustainable qualities, and those will be ongoing motivation, right, even in the hard times. And so the other part of fulfillment is, because it fills you up with so much confidence, you have resilience. And we are really being called on to use our resilience right now, at this moment in time. So right now it's March 17th, 2020, and the world is in a state, and we need to have resilience. And when you're filled up with fulfillment, when you have confidence in yourself, you know that you can face things. You have a well to draw from, that even when you are knocked down, you can bounce back up, which is, you know, the definition of resilience, that you bounce back. Yeah, you have been knocked down. Yeah, right? I mean, we cannot deny that. But you can bounce back up. And that's why fulfillment is a crucial step, even though people, you know, at first tend to resist it.
Right. It makes perfect sense. Everything you said just made perfect sense. I want to get your thoughts on solitude, because obviously many people in the world, not just in America, in the world, are in a forced state of solitude right now. And many creatives do like to put themselves in that state of solitude. But there's also the other side of, you know, where do you get your inspiration from? Ray Bradbury says, you know, you have to feast on life. You can't just hole away forever. You've got to go out there and be feasting on life to have something to bring back, excuse me, and use creatively. And I've been reading a lot on people who do isolate themselves for work. There's a book, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it's by Cal Newport, and it's called Deep Work. And
yeah,
and he studied how people just really lock themselves away for hours or days, even weeks at a time, on that solitude thing. So what's your perspective on solitude and creativity, and when is that time for solitude versus feasting on life?
You know, I use nature a lot in the book because nature is a grand template for creativity. You know, nature, I think we can all agree, exists. No matter what perspective we may have on life, on any, you know, social or political level, we can agree nature is a thing and that we come from nature. We exist in nature. So we can use her as a template, and she goes in cycles. You know, nature works in cycles. It goes from periods where, say, in winter we may be more solitary or inwardly focused, and in summer we may be more outwardly focused. Now, it doesn't mean we have to actually line up with the seasons, but she, nature is giving us cues that cycles are a good idea. Now, everybody has their own cycle, so it's important to get to know your cycle. You know, how much time do you need alone, and how much time do you need to be, you know, with others? So that's why I feel, again, taking ownership of your creative journey and saying, it's my creative journey. It's not going to be any prescription from someone else. You know, do 40 days of that and do 40 days of the other. No, it's got to be something that's, you know, specific to you. Only you have that. And that's a beautiful thing. In many ways, that's your creative voice being expressed. So one part is it does move in cycles, in my opinion, and the only way to know your cycle is to get to know yourself, which you can. It's not a mystery. You know, centering is a big practice throughout the book. I call it harmonizing with yourself, because when you harmonize with yourself, you listen to yourself, and you know your body will tell you when you need more solitude, when you need more social interaction. And by the way, during this time, people have been saying a lot about social distancing, and I'm trying to avoid that phrase because it's actually physical distancing. It's not social distancing.
Yes, it's physical, not emotional distancing.
Right, not at all. Yeah. So,
That's actually the perfect follow-up, what you just said about, you know, us understanding our seasons and a time for, you know, being busy and maybe being a little bit more laid back. Last week I talked with Dallas Hartwig, who wrote The Four Seasons Solution, and he was focused on life in general, not particularly creativity, but had the same kind of philosophy that, you know, there's a season for everything, and we need to listen to that. And if we were more in tune with nature in our work in general, we'd live happier, more productive lives. So.
I love that so much. I mean, I think we have such incredible internal wisdom, mind, body, and soul. I feel they all have different types of intelligence, those three major aspects of our lives, the mind, body, soul, and that we want to tap into all three. They each inform the other in different ways. And by centering and getting to know what those are for us, outrageous creativity bursts forward. And I think during this time of physical distancing, people are going to be listening more to themselves. They're going to encounter themselves more and be inspired by what comes up, even just within themselves, which is a huge amount. You know, going back to the idea of what can happen in isolation, a lot can happen. I think people are so distracted, myself included, sometimes, absolutely, I raise my hand, by day-to-day life,
right,
all the noise,
right.
That now we're getting a chance to quieten down. And, you know, I'll tell you, like, even though, of course, we're super sad about a lot of what's going on right now, people are also, like, almost guiltily confiding in me that I kind of like not rushing around right now. I kind of like not having to feel that I'm on the hamster wheel right now. I know it's maybe not sustainable to be in this holding pattern, but honestly, it's a relief. And
yes. Well, how many times have you heard people say, oh, I wish the world would just stop for a couple of days so I can catch up? You know, we didn't want it this way.
Absolutely.
I want to talk about a couple of things that you touch on, which I think are key. You talk about making mistakes, and you reference James Joyce referred to creative mistakes as portals of discovery. And you say we should make friends with mistakes. We should think of mistakes as our allies. Often when people make a mistake, that's when they give up. So share your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, I think about, you know, kids making mistakes, you know, when they're very small. Like, okay, for instance, learning how to speak. They babble away and everybody thinks it's adorable and they keep repeating the word correctly to them, but they don't shame them about babbling. They celebrate them for trying. And the kid keeps on trying, you know, and then they eventually learn how to speak fluently, right? This is the same for anything we're doing in life. You know, as soon as we start, and even when we're pretty expert in something, but we're learning a new aspect of it, we're kind of babbling a little bit. You know, we're still in that learning phase.
Right.
I think that needs to be, you know, celebrated and reflected and encouraged as a draft, you know, rather than, oh, no, this was an exam and you failed and you need to stop right now. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think of it like that. I mean, imagine if we shut children down when they were trying to learn how to speak. You know, they're babbling away and like, oh, no, you're wrong. They wouldn't actually learn, I believe, how to speak at all.
No, I think they'd stay quiet.
right?
Yes,
and,
yeah.
So I feel exactly the same way about mistakes or missed takes, as people sometimes call them. They're really drafts. And when we pathologize them and say they are, you know, really a terrible sign of something drastic, it's so dramatic. It's not like that. It's just a mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
And, it's a sign that we're growing. It's a sign that we're trying. It's a sign that we're not just trotting out the same old stuff as usual. You know, I think the judgment around mistakes is the big problem. Treating
right.
it like it's a bad thing.
Right.
You know, we do want to say, hey, you know, so say the kid's babbling, we still do correct them. We still do say the word the right way back to them, but we don't say it in such a way that's giving them any indication they were being bad or being a bad person. And as adults, when we make a mistake, we think it's a reflection on us. Wholesale, and a bad reflection.
And learning is really repetition, hopefully with improvement along the way. And that touches on something I heard you say on one of your videos. You have videos on YouTube with The Bright Way. And I heard you say the difference between mastery and performance, that mastery is precision and performance is flow. And
yeah.
I think we forget sometimes because everybody loves that state of flow. It's so organic and you just get lost in it. But there also has to be, you have to learn. I'm a writer. You have to learn your craft along the way. So there has to be space for that and space for you to make errors and move on. And you say it's important that we break things down into small chunks to repeat. And you say those chunks might be smaller than we think. So talk to us a little bit about those chunks, if you would.
Yeah, so I like to think of creativity as being on a pole that goes from skill to magic, back and forth. So skill is the more practical aspect, and the magical is the more intuitive and emotional aspect. And to me, they're actually all on the same pole. It's all creative, but you can emphasize certain parts of the pole at different times. And you, in fact, want to bring both ends of the pole together in order to manifest, in order to create. So if you ignore the practical side of the pole, for example, you really won't manifest that much. You know, you may have a lot of big dreams and big ideas, and those are marvelous and exciting, but you have no way to actually translate them into the physical world. You don't have the practical skill yet. So I am pretty clear that you do need to spend time with your practical aspects, with your technique, we could call it. And so there are some facts about learning, and amongst them is that in our goal for learning is to take things from short-term memory to long-term memory. So something goes into short-term memory for the first time. It's a new piece of information. You're trying something out. And it's still in short-term memory, and short-term memory means that it's not permanent yet. And short-term memory can only hold about 7 different pieces of information at once. And that's actually a pretty high number. I mean, sometimes people say it's less. Sometimes there are outliers who can hold a little bit more information. But in general, we'll say it's around 7 pieces of information. And so if you think about writing, for example, so you're a writer, seven pieces of information. You're trying to keep the entire book arc in mind as you're writing. You're thinking about all your different characters at that time that you're writing. You're thinking about what's happening in the story at that moment. You're thinking about what needs to happen in order to move the story forward. I mean, there's so many pieces of information that are happening already right at that second that we can easily overwhelm ourselves by taking on way too much. For example, if you wanted to memorize a poem, you could read it top to bottom over and over and over again, say it's a page long. It would be really hard to memorize it that way. There's just too many pieces of information going on. But if you break it down to, say, seven words at a time, and you repeated those seven words over and over again, that transfers them into long-term memory. Then you can move on to the next line, and another seven words, and, you know, or something that fits, you know, logically. It may have to be five, it may have to be a bit more, but, you know, something that fits logically. And you would keep repeating those, and that goes into long-term memory. So then what happens is you actually memorize the entire poem far faster than you would having just sat there and bit off too big of a chunk right away. If that makes sense.
Perfect sense. Absolutely. It's, yeah, I mean, if you're doing any big project, you want to chunk it down. So I think sometimes we forget to do that on creative projects.
Yeah.
You know, I think we think we're just going to sit down and write the great American novel or paint, you know, the next masterpiece in one shot without any breaks there. So my final question for you really is around, you say that you think of creativity as connection in more ways than one, and you say never be afraid to ask for help. Why is that so important?
Wow, for so many reasons. I find, again, going back to the isolation piece, that people oftentimes create alone. They write alone. They practice their instrument alone. Mothers feel isolated alone with their children. People do not share information. And it's really through collaboration that I believe our entire civilization exists and that it was built. It's by learning from others, both reaching out to them for emotional support and learning from them from the feedback they give to us on that, reaching out to them for informational support. You know, hey, I'm actually stuck on this thing. Can you give me some insight? Reaching out for spiritual support. You know, can you just hold space for me? Right now I feel afraid, and I would like to just know that you're there. And that spiritual connection happens. So I think isolation and disconnection is what scares us most. Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about fear, we think of fear as preventing creativity, stopping creativity. And when I look more closely at fears, a lot of those fears involve us becoming disconnected from things, disconnected from others, from ourselves, from our arts, from our livelihood. So by reestablishing our creativity, we reestablish connection with ourselves, with others, with our environment. And therefore, connection to me is really the ultimate goal of creativity. This is why we create. It's in order to connect to ourselves. Mm-hmm. So what I was speaking about earlier, that when you center and connect yourself, all this wisdom comes out. And that is greatly comforting. When you connect to others, you know, everything becomes better, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's a quote by Kurt Vonnegut I was going to quote, and it just flew out of my head, but it's something like, when you sit down to write, it's like making love to the world or something like that, because even though you're doing it in isolation, you know, you're hoping you're going to connect at some level. I didn't get that quite right, but it's along those lines. Yeah.
I love that. And I actually do believe, my personal belief is that when we connect in that deep way, when we engage in that type of of life force engagement, that mysteriously somehow we do all connect with everybody. I do believe that on some dimension we truly do connect, you know. And I think about, for instance, the Carmelite nuns who sequester themselves away and they pray for the world. I believe they actually make a difference. I don't think they're fooling themselves. And I get a question oftentimes from harpists in particular, because I work with a lot of harpists, and they say, I actually don't feel like performing. I'm not necessarily afraid of performing, but I don't feel called to perform. I feel called to play in my living room for myself. Is that legitimate? And I'm like, absolutely. Because when you are engaged in that kind of energy, I believe we all benefit mysteriously. I don't know exactly how this happens, but I absolutely believe that that connection glows super strongly.
Well, the book is called The Bright Way, Five Steps to Freeing the Creative Within. I know, Diana, people can find out much more about you at your website, dianarowan.com. There you can link out to Diana's YouTube channel and find out more about her work there and the work that she does with The Bright Way. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Diana?
Well, I'd like to reiterate that everybody is creative, that you were born creative, and that you can be creative at any time, any age, any place. And especially right now, I think it's so important to engage with our creativity, because creativity is what makes us feel fulfilled. Creativity is what brings us fulfillment. And I think we have a unique opportunity at this crazy moment in time to re-engage with our creativity and reclaim the amazing power that it gives us.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. And the book is packed full of so much. We haven't even touched the surface of it, really. but it's such a pleasure talking with you. It's packed full of tools and exercises that, you know, I sense want people to make creativity a joyous way of life. You've got that splattered all over your book. And yeah, I can sense it. Diana Rowan, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a delight. Thank you so much, Vicky.
And again, you can find out more about Diana at her website, dianarowan.com, and the book, The Bright Way, Five Steps to Freeing the Creative Within. And I want to thank each of you for joining us today. You can find more than 700 podcasts and more than 1,200 guest interviews at conversationslive.net. And we post a new podcast there every Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.